Hi, this is Circe Olson-Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm speaking to Army Brat author Robbie Lunt, and we are going to learn more about his interesting life as a brat and in the entertainment business, and then also as an author. So hi, Robbie, how are you?
Excellent. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. Hey, before we jump into your book, I want you to tell us a little bit about your brathood. Where all did you live and what kind of kid were you?
I bounced mostly between Germany and Maryland, which was kind of cool. We did live for a year in Fort Leavenworth, not at the prison. Mm. And I lived in Berlin and lived mostly in Munich.
Ah, so what was your dad? What was his MOS?
He actually was counter-espionage.
Ah, well, that would have been an interesting childhood you had right there.
It was fascinating. I was born in Augsburg, so in khaki diapers, I like to tell people.
Go ahead.
It was fascinating. And living in Berlin, I had friends growing up that were allowed to go to like Prague and take those wonderful trips. My mother and I and my sister were never allowed to cross those borders.
Mm. So because of your dad's job.
Yeah. It was definitely a little bit different than a lot of people's growing up.
So what kind of kid were you with a dad that knew all about spying and ways to get information? He probably knew everything about you all the time.
Yeah, pretty much. And I managed to get away with a lot for being that in that position, but yeah, it was interesting because he questioned people for a living.
Yeah.
So it's sad to say, but I got pretty good at working around the truth. So.
Uh-oh. Okay. I think that answered what kind of kid you were.
Yeah, probably the strap should have been used a little bit more on my behind.
So listen, I ask this of all my guests. What was your favorite place? Where was your favorite place to live as a child then?
Oh, without a doubt, Munich. I mean, I consider that my hometown. It's where I graduated from high school. And Munich is just, it's so gorgeous. It's, you have the mountains, you have the skiing and the hiking. And that's kind of why I live where I do now, because I have the skiing and the hiking, and it's a lot like Bavaria, except for the desert part.
Right. You're in Nevada, right?
Reno, yes.
Oh, yeah. So I think we have something in common. I saw somewhere that you went to the University of Maryland in Munich. So when was that?
It was 79 to 80, my first year of school outside of high school. It was, the thing was, is I lived in Munich, so it was a lot cheaper. I didn't go anywhere. And I got to live at home for that year. And it was a lot of fun. I got to participate in some of the activities that all the rest of you lucky people got to participate in. But, and then went home every night and got chastised for being late and that kind of thing. But it's also why it also actually, because I was attending there, that was the start of my career.
We're going to talk about that in a sec. So I don't know if you know this, but I compiled stories from hundreds of UMMC alums and two books. And then my friend Alex George, who also went to the University of Maryland, Munich. And I did a third book not too long ago. The common theme throughout all of the books, the anthology and the memories, is that Munich was such an impactful and special place to go to college. Can you share with our listeners a favorite memory of yours about the University of Maryland, Munich?
I love the size of the classes.
Mm.
I loved how everything was intimate. And I took a lot of theater classes there.
Mm.
So we actually did a performance. And the one thing I remember that was just amazing was when we got the props for the performances, we went to the Deutsches, the film place there.
Uh-huh.
There's a big film studio in Munich, and we got to go into their prop warehouses to pick out telephones. It's like miles and miles of telephones.
Wow.
It was absolutely amazing.
Where did you guys do the plays? Because I'm trying to picture where we did our theater productions at the university.
It was on the third floor. There was like an open room. It wasn't, the ceilings weren't that tall, but it was a fairly open size room. Mm. And we put on two plays. One of them was the 5th of July. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the other one. I can't remember the title of it, but I really remember the setup of it because it was about a poor woman that had suffered a stroke. And it was the use of a lot of mirrors and interesting lighting effects in such a small space was really fascinating.
Wow. Well, and you mentioned that you started your entertainment business career at the University of Maryland. So I think, like my husband, he worked as a stagehand as a college kid at Munich because all the concerts came through, setting up, tearing down. I think that's what you did too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I was working in the PX in the stereo department. Mm-hmm. And the Christmas before I graduated, somebody came in to work part-time and they asked me if I was staying through the summer. I told them, yeah. And then when they asked me if I was attending the Maryland, it was, oh, well, that's great, because I hired local stagehands, and that's how I got into it. I tell people now, they ask, how did you become a stagehand? It's like, well, I spoke English.
So what bands do you remember working for when you were in college at Munich?
You know, it's funny. There were two episodes that really set me off, that put me on the path. Mm-hmm. And one was The Who was playing at the Olympic Stadium. Mm-hmm. And I stood right in front of Pete Townsend's Stax. Mm-hmm. And it was a wild concert. They were snapping barricades at the front, and I was front stage security. But when they did the See Me, Feel Me part of the Tommy, mm-hmm. a single light lit up Roger Daltrey and everything went black. I mean, every single light was turned off. And in the midst of that, the truss raised up. And then there's a downbeat in that song where everything just rocks out. Mm-mm. When that happened, every light in the Olympic Stadium turned on, and it's all that plexiglass and all those pylons. Mm. And just the truss had raised up, and you could see The Who spelled out. And then I turned around and saw I believe it was 35,000 people all with their hands in the air screaming. And it just, that was a pretty big impact on me at that point.
I was going to say, that was it for you, huh? You were going to be a stagehand or a rock star or something.
Well, and the other time was, we continued on, and a bunch of us went to Kaiserslautern to help set up a concert there at a soccer stadium. Mm-hmm. And it had been pretty stormy, so we had rigged up something in front of the sound towers, which were 70 feet high. Mm-hmm. And somehow the eye bolts on each of the, or the grommets on the big tarp they put in front of the sound tower, mm-hmm. they all got tied. And so somebody had to go and cut them loose. And so I went and started climbing this tower, and I went side to side and cut it. And as I got 3/4 of the way up, I started to almost feel this buzz going on. And the sound of the crowd had changed a little bit. And I got higher and higher, and the buzz started getting louder and louder. And I actually realized that the whole crowd was watching me do this. And I got to the very end, and I cut one corner, and I cut the other corner. And I turned around, and this was close to 70,000 people. And I had the knife in my hand, and I just raised it up in the air. And when I raised it up in the air, the crowd went nuts. And I just swept it down, and I cut the last tie line. And when the tarp hit the ground, the sound guy, bless his heart, had been watching me. Mm-hmm. And the minute I hit that last rope and it dropped, he just cranked the audio up. The 70,000 people were going, ah, and that was it.
So what was the band?
It was Fleetwood Mac. Uh-huh. With the special guest was Bob Marley.
Oh, wow.
And then it was Don McLean, Rock Pile, and the Little River Band.
Oh, wow. So it was like an all-day affair.
Oh, absolutely. And this was the very beginning of it. It was a lot of fun because we did it in Munich, and then we did it in Kaiserslautern.
Wow, very cool, very cool. So unlike my husband, you still work in the entertainment industry. So what do you do now?
I spent many years as a lighting guy. Mm-hmm. In fact, at one point in my career, I was the lighting director for Universal Studios in Orlando. And then when they opened up City Walk, the nightclub area, I was the lighting director there. When I moved out west, that was about 20 years ago, mm-hmm. I did lighting for a while, but now I've transitioned into, I work corporate theater. When people do conventions and they have keynote speakers come in, mm-hmm. I'm the guy that deals with their videos and their PowerPoints.
Oh, that's not quite the same as 70,000 people yelling and cheering for you.
you know, though, corporate theater is always paid better than actually live performance.
Yeah.
And there is something about being in there with the motivational speakers, mm-hmm. and everyone, the jazz is still there. That buzz is still there. And when everybody in the room is, you know, clapping, it's hell. If there's three people in the room, it's still there. So
no, I understand, because I worked as a puppeteer one summer and went around to all these schools. I mean, and we were, mm-hmm. they were crummy puppets and we were having a lot of fun, but the kids, they just, I mean, we were like rock stars, and, you know, they would come up and want our autographs and they wanted to talk to us and touch us. And so, yeah, you know, it is there. There's a spark and an excitement when you're working with making performance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's making the magic.
Yeah, the magic. That's a Disney term, I think. So did you graduate from college with a major in technology?
I went to Gainesville, mm-hmm. and I majored in technical theater, and then I just started. Florida had an incredible student crew. Mm-hmm. So the student crew that I was working with at the University of Munich, mm-hmm. I transitioned to another crew that was working at that level. When I went there, and they still do, they have the largest student run pep rally in the world. Anyway, they had their keynote speakers were people like George Burns and Robin Williams and Jay Leno and that kind of level of comedian for just this huge pep rally at homecoming.
Wow.
And then they had a bunch of concerts. So it was wonderful. They always interviewed the new students coming in. Mm-hmm. And so I had to sit in front of this board of seniors and graduate students so they could make sure that I would have the mindset and be able to work and be a stagehand. And that interview went fairly well, I have to say.
Wow.
Because I just listed off all the bands that I had worked with in Munich, and they're like, oh, okay. And there was no question. It's like, you're on the crew and you're immediately here, come and show these people how to run a follow spot.
That is so cool. We are actually going to transition a little bit to your writing career here. So
okay.
Did you always want to be a writer secretly deep down, or is this something that came late on in life?
I've always done well in English classes and in writing. Mm-hmm. I prefer to write poetry personally. You know, the story, these things had happened to me, and just people kept going, well, you really need to write this book. And you really did. So I eventually, I found the reason to write it. Actually, my co-author, he was doing a bunch of interviews about paranormal investigation, and somebody brought up the demon word to him, and he told them something about what had happened. And I had to call him up. I actually hadn't spoken to him for about 20 years, and I had to call him up and go, no, you got that all wrong. And then it turned into the book that it did.
Well, so I was going to say, I did a little research on you. And I got the impression that you've been working as a paranormal investigator. And then I think on your website or profile, there was the word arcanologist. Mm-hmm. What is that?
It's actually, that's a term that my friends and I have coined. And we search in for the hidden and the things that are kept in the shadows. It's the easiest way for me to describe it is in Kung Fu, there are students and they go and they take lessons from the master. But then the master has the small handful of students that he takes, and they're called closed door students. And they actually learn the real things, the depths of the actual art that most of the students don't learn. Those would be the arcanologists that are following things in Kung Fu. In Judaism, the study of the Kabbalah is the arcane, those deep teaching levels. I study some Tibetan Buddhism, and I study Bon, which is actually the deep levels of the Tibetan Buddhism that still bring in a lot of the shamanism of the indigenous people. So it's, we look for the roots of things.
Well, the arcane means the deep, the hidden. Oh, cool. Interesting. So here's an off-the-wall question I'm just going to throw out to you. So as a writer, what would you choose as your mascot or your avatar or your spirit animal if you were going to pick one?
Well, see, it because of my path, I actually have spirit guides that are animals, and one of them is a dragonfly. The other one is an owl, and the owl is kind of apropos. It's in a lot of cultures, it's seen as a harbinger of ill, but it's also in our Western cultures, it's seen as a sign of wisdom and learning.
Yeah,
and I love to, I just, research is a problem for me because I get lost. I just start digging and going and going and going and going.
So I understand the owl, but what about the dragonfly?
Dragonflies are amazing warriors. And the time I spent in Florida and the places I liked, they're always in the swamps. And that's the one thing I miss living out here in Reno is I really miss the swamps in the back places in Florida.
Wow. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of swamps in Reno. So I've never talked to a paranormal investigator. I've never talked to anybody who's done this work, but I had a question before we get into your book and just my own imagination. Are you sympathetic with the spirits that you work with?
I don't really do paranormal investigation like you see them when people go in with the mediums and all of that. Because I don't have to.
Okay.
I go into a place and I know immediately whether it's haunted or not. And yes, that's one of the things that upsets me with the paranormal investigative teams is a lot of times they go in and they're being antagonistic. They're trying to rile them up, and there's no reason. It's like, leave the poor people in peace. So yes, I have a lot of sympathy for the beings that are there. Especially because ghosts, that's the other thing is most paranormal investigators put everything into three categories. You have residual hauntings, which is where energy gets trapped, and then if everything's right, that energy will come back out, and if people are sensitive, they'll relive those moments. The other is an interactive haunting, which is something, a ghost that's actually manifesting in such a way that there's interaction, intelligent, and then there's poltergeists. But there's so much more out there. There's so many more things than those three entities. And so I have a lot of sympathy for a lot of the beings. Absolutely.
So how did you get involved in that? I mean, that's a long stretch from, you know, coming, working stage sound and techno. How did you get involved in the first place?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's not that far of a stretch, because any theater you work in, I'll guarantee you is haunted. And any stagehand you work with after a long time will have ghost tales to tell you. But for me, I was doing, it was the there's a Stephen Foster home in Northern Florida, and they have a bluegrass festival every year. And as the lighting guy, I would set my stuff up, and then I would, we would camp out there for the week, but I only had to work after dark. And the, one of the video engineers, his wife started talking to me and telling me the problems she was having at her house. And so we had a long talk, and I told her she really needed to get some help. And then later on, we, I met her a couple months later, and it had gotten, her house had gotten really bad. So it was basically, we were trying to figure out what we had to do to help her. Now, the thing I find fascinating about it all is I'd always kind of been interested in paranormal. And somehow my, my dad got me my first deck of tarot cards. My dad got me a Ouija board. He always gave, he always sent me along those lines. And I am pretty sure that he was very familiar with the remote viewing program, if you know what that is.
I don't. So
the Army and, well, the CIA, but it was a lot of the Army.
Are we allowed to talk about this, or will we be executed?
Oh, there's people out that have been on a lot of radio shows that have talked about it.
Okay, I just don't want
to. Oh, no, no, I wouldn't do that to you.
Thank you.
But there's a process that you go through where you learn how to be able to remote view things, like sitting in this room and being able to see something at a remote spot. And there are trained officers that know how to do this.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Like, kind of like hypnosis, sort of, but not really.
Well, it would be, the, actually, it's really close, because what you would do is you would put yourself into a hypnotic state and then allow your consciousness to travel somewhere else.
Oh, wow. Well,
and
that could be a whole program in itself.
Oh, it's days worth of program. It's a fascinating thing. And in the people that have talked to the public, it's pretty, they're pretty dead on. You know, once you learn what you're looking at and learn the process, if you have that talent, you can actually get out there and make those contacts. It's pretty fascinating. In fact, I was watching a program with my wife, and it was on remote viewing, and they went to Fort Meade, and I said, remember when I took you there? And she kind of looked at me, and then they showed the, like, the offices where they didn't, and said, remember when I showed you that building? And she started scooching away. And then they showed where most of the remote viewers lived on base. And it's like, remember when I told you I lived at the corner right there?
Wow. Wow.
That's when she got up and kind of moved away.
Wow. So I want to talk about your book. You've written a book. It's called Demon Street USA, and the whole title is actually called Demon Street USA, The True Story of a Very Haunted House. So please tell our listeners a little bit about the book, and then how you got involved in writing it, and why did it need to be written in the first place?
Well, it was a very, like, we actually touched on it a little bit earlier. And our friend, when I saw her again, and we started talking about what was happening in her house, I told her originally that she needed to move out. And when I saw her several months later, she told me that night she had moved out. She had been living in a little apartment, and she moved into the landlord's house. And then in the middle of the night, the stove started to dance, and then a ripple went through a hardwood floor, picked her up in the air and dropped her. And that's when she ran out of the house screaming. And so she told me this story, and I had had some interesting experiences with my co-author, Dave, and decided that, you know, maybe we could go and at least check the place out, because who doesn't want to go check out a haunted house? And it ended up being exceptionally haunted. In fact, my elevator speech always was, when the little redneck comes up to you, looks you in the eye and goes, I can conjure demons, can you? And he's serious, and he can. It's, it makes for a wild ride. But the book really, it's not like the Amityville Horror. The title kind of irks me, but you go with what the publisher chooses.
Right.
And because it's really not a book like the most books, like the Amityville Horror and those kinds of books. What you do is you read about, oh, this happened, this happened, this happened. And then we called these people in and they helped us, or we ran.
Right, right.
Well, what this book really is, oh my God, our friend is living in hell. What do we do? What can I do to learn how to deal with these things? So there's a huge chunk of the book is actually the lessons I went through to learn how to deal with what was ultimately a demonic infestation.
So I'm thinking about this, how do you write a book? How does one go researching this book and writing? And this is a nonfiction book. Mm-hmm. But it's a nonfiction book where a lot of people might say you're making up the story. It's a fiction book. This doesn't really happen. How do you establish credibility? And then how do you research it to make yourself look more credible?
Well, it was very interesting because I had to remember a lot of the story, quite honestly. Like I said, I had called my co-author and said, you got it totally wrong. And then we started exchanging things. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, do you remember when this happens? Like, I kind of do, but help. And that's one of the reasons why I had contacted him, because I needed that, the rest of that memory mm-hmm. that I didn't have. And unfortunately, he had forgotten so much of it, but he brought back key points of it. And then we wrote the book together. And as we were doing it, we kept remembering things. And then we had wonderful instances like my wife going, oh, well, do you remember when the elevator opened on the floor that wasn't there? And I actually had to sit there for a minute and go, no, yeah. So it was bringing that stuff back, and the research really brought it back. It's funny because when we were dealing with it originally, mm-mm. I had to do the research the old-fashioned way. I had to go into courthouses and dig through, you know, plat lines and do all kinds of hardcore look at microfiche for hours and hours and hours. Mm-hmm. And when I redid the research, because I wanted to make sure that I was correct on everything, oh, the internet's a wonderful tool. And the internet answered questions too. Like the gentleman's grandfather, it was really weird how I couldn't find any information on him, yet he was one of the largest landowners in an adjacent county. And I found how he was a very powerful man. And it was only through the most recent research that I also found out there was a town there in North Florida that from 1912 to 1938, the town's on the map. And after 1938, there's no town there anymore.
Yeah, I did some research on when before I interviewed you, so I know a little bit about it, but I don't want to spoil it for the person who wants to read your book.
Right.
I did interview somebody just this morning who's also he's a memoirist, and he said flat out that memories are lies. he remembered this exact incident, and then his brother said, "Nah, it wasn't quite like that." So yeah, you do have to do your due diligence and you know, verify. So you mentioned a co-author, David Roundtree.
Yep.
And he's also a shaman. How did you guys meet? How did you meet?
Well, we met, I did a tour. And when I came back off of tour, I needed a gig. And he was looking for somebody at the university to be the master electrician for the performing arts series. So I took that was one of the jobs that I did because we lived in Gainesville for about 11 years.
So he's also like works with the theater and
yes.
Lighting and okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Well, the theater draws people that are different.
Well, creative for sure.
Exactly. And so you find that a lot of people that work in this industry are definitely believers in the paranormal.
Well, I know that there's a theater in Albuquerque called the Chemo that they say is haunted. And I mm-hmm. just read somewhere, about another theater, and I can't remember where it is, but over decades, people have built a shrine to the resident ghost, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
And so before every performance, they decide on a prop or a thing that they're going to leave from the, and I don't know if it's from the run or for the each performance, but they do. They leave the shoes or the hats or the vase of flowers, you know, there's something.
So that's awesome.
So they leave it for the, mm-hmm. and so it's been made into quite a shrine over the decades, I guess, the years. I'm terrible with exact details, but the concept was really
right.
Interesting. Yeah. So you're dealing in this book with hugely sensitive topics and events.
Yeah.
And real people are involved and real history is involved. So what do you owe privacy-wise or historically accuracy-wise to the people that are mentioned in the book?
The people that I'm still in contact with, I actually personally called each of them,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And went as far as to go, do I use your name? Do you want me? I allowed several people to actually choose their pseudonym.
Okay.
Right. The people I couldn't get in contact with, well, everybody's name was changed for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to keep it very... There was a lot of things that happened that didn't make the book because we wanted to keep at least a level of decorum.
Yeah.
Interesting. I wanted to be very careful.
Well, I think that's a dilemma we all have, especially when we're dealing with memoirs. You know, you think about it. So this person was kind of a jerk in the book. For example, a book, you know, the book you're mm-hmm. writing, like if I were writing a book, do I really want to include them in there? Is it important to the story or do I want to make it kinder or, you know, so there's a dilemma. And so there's a responsibility to, you know, tell the truth, but not, you
right.
know, dwell on the negative or the, you know, bizarre. And so you do want to be courteous, mm-hmm. I guess respectful is the word. I was looking at. So what did you learn most about yourself as you were writing this particular book?
Learned I actually like to write. was very interesting.
Your English teachers will be proud of you.
I mean, we did 13 revisions of the book before we went to sell it.
Wow.
So, and then we had to do the revisions for the publisher, which was a whole nother thing. You know, it's interesting, not so much in the writing of the book, but the, I don't want to say fallout, mm-hmm. but the ramifications of the book being published,
mm-hmm.
I learned a whole lot of things that I had wished that I had known then, that I know now.
Well, that hindsight is 2020, huh?
Absolutely. And then back when this all happened in 1985,
mm-hmm.
And back in those days, there weren't any paranormal investigative groups. There really was nobody to go to other than the books and research. And Dave had a background. Mm-hmm. I really didn't have a background other than I had been studying things for my whole life, pretty much.
So I'm listening. And so what I'm hearing is that you actually didn't self-publish. You had a publisher, you had an agent, you did traditional publishing for this.
Didn't get an agent
mm-hmm.
and I really wanted to go traditional. And so we went ahead and submitted it to the publisher directly. And it was funny. We were in the process of submitting it
mm-hmm.
and my co-author Dave had a paranormal investigative group up in New Jersey, and he was at one of these conventions
mm-hmm.
and a publisher came up to him and said, man, I love the way you talk. Do you have a book? And immediately gave him my phone number and I had the whole packet ready to send them. But the cool thing and the thing that really made me feel good about it is 2 months after we had signed the contract with New Page Books,
mm-hmm.
Llewellyn called me and asked me if the project was still available. So I had the number one publisher of esoteric books in the world asked me if the project was, and I got to say no. How many people get to say no to a publisher?
I know. And especially Llewellyn, even I have books published by Llewellyn. Wow. In hindsight, would it have been greater to have gone with Llewellyn? Or are you allowed to say that?
No, I'm very happy. What did I learn? Mm-hmm. I learned the whole submission process. Oh, wow. Talk about our game. Mm-hmm. My one suggestion to any author out there is queryshark.com.
Shark.com?
Query.
Oh, Query Shark. Shark.
Shark.com.
What is that?
It's a woman she's an agent at one of the top firms in New York. And what you can do is you can send her your query letter and she will absolutely destroy it. And then you can redo it and you can send it to her again. And you can continue to send her the query letter until she goes, I'd look at the book. And then you know you have a winner of a query letter.
You know, that's really great because, you know, that is like, no publisher anymore takes anything unless you have either an agent or a good query letter or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good thing. I actually wrote a novel years ago, right when I was out of college. And I wrote a really good query letter because I had like every major publishing company say, oh, we'd love to see the book. Then they all saw the book and they said, oh, it really sucks. They didn't say it quite like that, but they meant it. So at least I had the query letter done right. But unfortunately, the novel never got published. It never left my, you know, the ego packed it far away. but for a few exciting moments, I had publishers wanting to see my manuscript. But it was based on a good query letter. So this woman, this service, does she do that for free or do you pay her?
Oh, yeah. And no, it's free. Wow. And what I did, now she doesn't do it for my genre. But I read every single one she did and watched how they worked it and watched how she would just trim it down and trim it down to where what it needed. So I had a one-page query letter that I was very, very happy with. And so, yeah, the minute I sent the packet to the publisher, it's like, oh, yeah, we'll go.
Wow, that's awesome.
But you have the, you know, that art, though. That's, I tell you what, that, and what I've learned is that really, that's so much of being an author.
Well, I would say that it was probably dumb luck because I was 19 or 20. It might have been an off month. There was nobody else submitting manuscripts. I'm sure that's what it was. It was like one of those months where nothing was happening. So Circe is going to write this great letter.
I don't know. You've done the proper thing, though. You put it on the shelf. See, now is when you want to bring it back out and go, and then you can fix all that.
I actually started looking at it again, and I thought that's on my list to do this year. You know, 20 years later, but so much has changed in the world, so I'm thinking about it. But I'm quite content just podcasting at the present moment. but I wanted to ask you another question. So you do paranormal work and you know, we've talked a little bit about it. Does having a particular religious faith play into your decision to do this work? And do your experiences and your work with the paranormal, does it strengthen or weaken your belief in God?
That's a good one.
I was going to say, that's why I'm not writing novels anymore, because I'm just thinking of
questions. The thing is I'm not a very religious person. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was a period of my life where I really had nothing but contempt for organized religion. I've totally 180'd on that, because the Buddha says there are 83,000 paths to enlightenment. You just got to find the one that's best for you.
Right.
And I'm more along those lines. My spiritual beliefs, on the other hand, yes, play a tremendous part in what I do. Mm-hmm. But I've been very, very lucky with my teachers. One of my teachers right now is The Way of Nature, and it's John Milton. And what we do is we go out and do retreats, take people out. When I did my personal one, it was 7 days alone in the Chiricahua Mountains.
Wow.
And my spirituality plays a huge part in it. And definitely God is such an interesting concept. Because no, I don't believe in the guy sitting on a throne in a beard and that kind of thing. I'm not a creationist. However, I do believe in intelligent design, because so much of this stuff clicks in that. And I fully and absolutely believe in the angels and their fallen brethren, because those who that's the beings I work the most with. On the other hand, everybody has their own reality.
Right. Well,
so
well, but you know, I think I hear you saying though that you believe in divine something.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just how that divine manifests is where I get lost, because a lot of my teachers, there's the belief that when we all die, we all go to the big pool. But if you work hard enough, then you actually don't go diving in the pool and become part of the water. You maintain a certain amount of cohesion. On the other hand, since writing the book and things have happened and I've really had contact with my past lives, I know a lot more about that. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to blow that one off, because I know what I was in my past life and I know what I've been in several lives prior to that. And it's very hard to describe, but so I can't really go with the whole, we all jump into a huge pool.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My thought process for the longest time was, well, yeah, that's what happens. And that's why you have bits and pieces of memory, because it's all of that soul, basically God. Mm-hmm. Is there, and he mixes you up and he goes, okay, here, let's learn some more stuff, and throws you back out there with bits and pieces. And then some people have a stronger cohesion to a wholeness of themselves than others, yet we still go back to the source, because in reality we all are part of the source.
That's a lot to unwrap. That's really So I'm going to ask you this, because you are a brat. You grew up in different parts of the world and you were exposed to different cultures and, you know, probably religions and all that. Do you think your being a brat made you more aware, more tolerant, more open to other? Because, I mean, you talked about the Kabbalah, you talked about Buddhism, you talked about, you know, different things. Were you more, do you think your brat upbringing and experiences made you more open to paranormal and different paths?
Oh, without a doubt. Because if my father had not been in the military, I would have probably been born and raised in Utah as a Mormon.
Okay.
But my father joined the military, and our library around the house, there were books everywhere, always. So I've always been exposed to the books. That was the hardest part of being a brat, was giving up my books. I didn't care about any of the rest of it, but giving up my books, that was horrible.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little bit of a bookaholic myself. My husband and I just moved here on a temporary assignment, and I packed, I don't know, maybe 3,000 pounds of books, you know? I mean, we had two moving trucks. All the neighbors in the whole neighborhood were looking at us like, you're only here for a temporary, you're never going to get it all in the house. But I did. But yeah, books everywhere and all sorts of different books. So in the last few minutes, what do you want our listeners to know about you or your work or an interesting story you want to share? Have you written anything else? Did I see that you've written something else?
No, I haven't. I actually haven't written any books. I've written a couple of poems that have won some prizes. So I'm a prize winning poet on top of it.
Oh, with whom do they get prizes from?
Writer's Digest.
Oh, okay. Cool.
So yeah, and I'm enjoying that a lot. You know, the just the only thing I would do right now, and I'm wearing this t-shirt specifically for it's the IOTC t-shirt.
Okay.
It's the people that are working in Hollywood, and that it's you know, go out, see a concert, support those artists, don't ask for the free passes. you know, and it's funny, for the longest time, I would always take music from people and I would always borrow books from people. And now that I'm an author, I don't borrow books anymore. I only buy the books, and I only, if I hear a song and I really like it and I download it, I pay for it. So pay those local artists because they're needing the money right now.
Especially right now. No, people don't it's a hard thing because you want to buy your books and get a good cheap price for them, but yet they don't realize that if you buy a used book, they're not getting the royalty to the person, who wrote it, or it may be a very diluted royalty. So yeah, need to
Well, my heart is torn apart because I grew up in the library. I love libraries, you know, that I half lived in one growing up, and now I don't want them to have my book because then people won't buy it.
Well, that's a hard thing. At least they're checking it out though.
Now,
What would be worse is if your book stayed on the shelf for a decade and nobody looked at it.
that's very true. Now, the one thing from a brat point of view that I have to say is when I was growing up and we would go and like stay at my grandparents' house and I'd play with the kids across the street and they'd talk about being in the same class and the same school. And I grew up jealous of those kids. And now that I'm here, oh no, I had the upbringing. We had the upbringing, all of us that were so blessed to be born into the service and grow up in the service. And I think, you know, that's what happens to brats. Brats either become very gung-ho and go right back into it, or they turn into long-haired hippies like me. But the one thing we never lose, though, is the fact that we appreciate the life we had. And no matter what happens, no matter what any of the politics are, brats are always number one patriotic over everything else. But I have to get on the brat, I have to get on that brat box because I'm so blessed to have grown up this way.
Well, no, you're right, and I think that is a common theme with brats. So I don't know if you know this, but DoDEA, which is the school system, turned 75 this year.
Really?
Yeah, it started in 46 and it's
Okay.
75 years. And when it started, nobody knew, how long it would last. It was there for the military, knew how long the military was going to be overseas. So you went to Munich High School. Any other DoD schools?
yes, I went to Berlin Elementary. I went to Munich Elementary. I went to Meade Senior High, which is, I think it's a public school, but it's on the base. And you know, I had the one real interesting experience as we lived in Berlin. I started off at the elementary school there, and then for my fifth grade year, I went to the John F. Kennedy Schule. Are you familiar with that?
No, it sounds like it's a German school, though.
It's a German American school. The first day you go to class, everything is taught in English. The next day you go to class, everything is taught in German. And it just rotates like that with an hour each day where I would go for where the German kids would go for their English class, I would go and get a recap of what was taught the day before, and vice versa.
Interesting.
So yeah, it was a very immersive school, and that was one of the most fascinating places I went, and it wasn't one of the DoD schools.
But it's interesting. That is so interesting. So are you bilingual? German, English?
I used to be, but you know, you lose those
You
things.
lose those things. Well, so where can people find your book? We have to wrap it up because we're going down a rabbit hole, and I would love to continue that we're going down that, and we got to stay focused. So I wanted to talk about your books today. So that's what we're going to talk about. Where can they find them? Your book, is it in your website?
Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
Amazon.
Okay.
And you can get it as either the covered book or ebook.
Okay, so it's both ebook and
yes.
Okay, good. I can put a link to your website if you have one, and definitely to the book. You know, I can.
No, I do most of my stuff through Facebook.
Okay. All right. Well, if you can, I will link to whatever you send me, and I'll put it at the bottom of the
podcast. Excellent.
All right, excellent. Well, in the last couple of seconds left, do you have anything else you'd like our listeners to know about you, your life, etc.?
No, I really appreciate this, and I appreciate what you're doing. It's good to get the Brat stories out there.
Yeah, well, they're all different, you know. There's a mm-hmm. lot of commonality, but then your experiences are so different than another Brat's. But yet you're all related, you know, it's
very, yeah.
It's,
and you know, as much as I understand the bad things about things like Facebook and that mm-hmm. Facebook has been such a boon to the community.
Right. Right.
The Munich High School community is very vibrant. In fact, they just had the Brat reunion mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
For Munich Brats, and it was when Munich does a reunion, because the graduating class was 79 people. Mm-hmm. So when Munich does a reunion, it's basically everybody who's ever attended Munich High School is invited.
Yeah, my graduating class I think was 32, so very small. Okay, well, I wanted to thank you for coming on the podcast today. This was really thought-provoking and interesting, and a little different than what we usually do. I wanted to thank Robbie Lunt very much for coming on, and I wanted to remind our listeners that this podcast was brought to you by our museum, the Museum of the American Military Family and Learning Center, and our podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brat Seal and Military Brats Registry. So thank you so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.